Chen, good morning. There are more state law trials in the meeting than members of parliament. That doesn't mean you can take decisions on our behalf. Welcome, and thank you for making yourselves available. I understand that the Honourable Debbie Schaefer is caught up, as are others. I was caught up myself. I was scheduled to make a presentation. I thought it would be at 8:30, but it turns out it will be around about 9:30, 9:45. And so I had to leave the Honourable John Jeffrey to do it on my behalf. Mr. J.B. Sibagnoni is caught up in the same meeting. I have no other apologies, Mr. Romano, unless you are aware of them. What about them? All right. Nkosi Patigile Holomisa is in Zimbabwe. Don't ask me why, but he's there. Ah, okay. Parliamentary forum. Alright. Mam Shopistole is going to see a doctor. We hope she's not feeling too badly. Okay. Mr. Bassett, when we last met, we were dealing with the what we referred to as, what are those called, those notes at the bottom? Footnotes.
That's correct, Chair.
And so we had reached clause.
We got to the penalty clause.
Penalty clause, which is?
Clause 13 on page 21, I think it is.
Right, okay.
And I don't know whether, I think the members indicated that they would like to study the document that we prepared on the penalty clauses. It's a document.
Yes, there is a document.
Comparative.
Yes.
Table of penalties and proportionality of sentences. So we hadn't concluded the discussion on the penalty clause.
But we can proceed anyway.
That's correct, yes.
whilst members are looking at that, because it's quite involved. So I suggest then we move on and go on to 14, is it?
We can do that, Chair. With your permission, may I just add, it would help us as drafters on the penalty clause. I know you're going to come back to us on what our recommendations were, and just to refresh your memory, our recommendation on the penalty clause was that perhaps only the main offence have a fine, which is similar to the one of the maximum fines in poker, and that's 400 million rand or life imprisonment. But where, if committee members could possibly think about it, the question arises with the drafters would like guidance on the aspect. These penalty clauses, particularly as far as the fines are concerned, would exclude the jurisdiction of the lower courts. And I'm thinking here really of the regional courts, because I would like to think that matters of this nature will either be tried in the regional court or perhaps more appropriately in the higher courts. I don't think they would land up in the district courts, but if they are to be tried in the district courts and in the regional courts, and if the regional courts are to impose the penalties that the committee is going to put into clause 13, then I might need to put a provision in to give the lower courts, or possibly restricted to the regional courts, specific jurisdiction to impose those penalties, notwithstanding their limited criminal jurisdiction in terms of the Magistrates Courts Act.
Chair, thank you. I think Mr. Bassett has correctly captured what we discussed, that we should put in the fine in the main 13.1. I can't remember 400 million, was that what we were talking about? But I think that is important because of the Adjustments of Fines Act and the problem with that, which linked 20,000, I think it was, 30,000 to 1 year, and that is a separate issue we might want to note for our report on the bill, that must be amended. But I'm fully in agreement with the mention of an amount, and then it will have the consequence that we would need to put a clause in. I would think that these matters need to be dealt with in the regional court. Was your suggestion as well as the district courts, but I'm not sure about that, but at the very least we need the jurisdiction of the regional court. Is there a monetary limit on the jurisdiction of the regional court, because they can impose life imprisonment? Yeah.
Can, Chair, yes. In terms of the minimum sentencing legislation, funnily enough, regional courts can impose life imprisonment in respect of the offences that are mentioned there. But when it comes, their ordinary jurisdiction at the moment in terms of the Magistrates' Courts Act, regional courts can impose a sentence up to 15 years and the corresponding fine is 300,000 rand. So regional courts only have jurisdiction up to 300,000 rand and 15 years imprisonment. District courts, it's in this document. I can just refresh my memory. I think it's 60,000 rand.
Yeah. Just what is the NPAs? Do they normally prosecute in the regional court with these matters? I think that's probably so. And bear in mind that this 13(1) is subject to minimum sentences. So are we not going to 13(1) read subject to Section 51 of the Criminal Procedure Act?
Only in respect to the main offence.
So your point is well taken. I think we need to look at that, to add the jurisdiction going down to include, but we're not going to, if I understand what you're suggesting, we're not going to include a monetary amount in the lower offences. The top offences will give guidance as to what we are thinking of.
That's the department's approach, but it's for the committee to take a final decision.
That'll determine where the matter is heard, isn't it? Yeah.
But then we would need to put in the clause to specify for the jurisdiction of the regional court. So we don't have to finalise this now, Chair, but this maybe we can just note this is our thinking, this along these lines.
Okay, it's work in progress. All right, Mr. Bassett.
Then we can move on to clause 14, which is factors to be considered in sentencing, and I'm going to ask my colleagues to assist.
Chairperson, with regard to clause 14, there were no amendments following the meetings of the 6th of September.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very nice.
Yes.
No footnotes, so we can proceed.
Going to page 23 of the document. There's a footnote 64. That was done as a request by the committee on the 6th of September. I just want to quickly see. That's right, yes.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
Then
the note can come up then.
The beginning of that clause 15 as well, there also you will see who any person who knows, suspects, or ought reasonably to have known or suspected, that is still subject. The committee asked us last week to have a look at that as well, to tie it up with clause 2. So that is work in progress as well.
If you can go to page 24 of the document, footnote 65, we suggest there the inclusion of a reference to clause 33b5, which provides that upon entry of a child who is suspected of being a victim of trafficking and who is repatriated to the Republic, the Department of Home Affairs must refer that child to a child protection organization or provincial Department of Social Development, to be dealt with in terms of the Children's Act. That was just to put it in there to refer to that clause as a duty which must be done by the provincial department there as well.
Let's look at 33. The
on page 53.
So those little square brackets where it says refer the child to, those come out, eh? In 33B5.
That's correct.
Okay, refer the child to designated child protection organization or provincial, that's fine.
The brackets come out.
Yeah, those little square brackets.
That makes sense. That's not very easy to see, but the there are deletions for the square brackets, sure.
Okay.
If you can proceed to footnote 66, that was also in line with the suggestion by this committee on the 6th of September, that the Provincial Department of Social Development must assess whether the child is a victim of trafficking and no longer the child protection organization. Going to footnote 67, that amendment was just to bring sub-clause 6 in line with the amendment in sub-clause 5.
Honourable members have just walked in. We're on page 24 and we're still dealing with the footnotes, and presently we're looking at footnote number 66. I think that makes sense, Steve.
Footnote 68.
As we think 65, 66, 67, again, the first footnote.
Yeah, once we're done with that page, then we'll agree that all those footnotes must come out. Alright? Thus far they all come out. But, yeah. 68 now.
Footnote 68 is once again the committee on 6 September indicated that a police official should not be subject to a criminal sanction, so we have removed the reference there to the police official.
Okay. If I may come in here, the next clause is the one that is always presented as quite a number of challenges. The committee asked us to have a look at the situation in other countries where there is compulsory reporting of adult victims of trafficking. And we did circulate a document. I don't know whether you want Pingala to take the committee through that document to give an overview of what the situation in other countries.
Yeah, it was distributed. It's called the Law on Mandatory Reporting of Adult Victims of Trafficking in Persons and Consent of Adult Victim to be Reported. And One is Zambia, two Mozambique, etc., etc. If you don't have it, Mr. Romano will try and organize that you get a copy.
Chairman, while the document is being distributed, may I point out that in this debate there are two aspects. One is the obligation, what we must report, whether it's mandatory or not mandatory. And the other one, what it is that you need to report, the knowledge or the suspicion. And I think that that's an additional element that we must not lose perspective of, because I don't have a problem with the obligation of reporting knowledge. I do have an enormous problem with the obligation of reporting a suspicion.
All right, maybe we should debate that matter now, Mr. Jeffrey.
You just have to support report knowledge. It's pretty worthless. It's completely worthless, in fact, because it basically. I see the introduced bill was suspicion. I mean, how is his how are any of these people going to know? They're not. They're going to have a suspicion, and that's what that they should report. I mean, you've got an immigration officer, so they see this these people coming through the border post. They don't know, but they think the situation looks funny. Let me report the suspicion.
You see, Mr. Chairman, our country is committed, amongst many other things, to a protocol adopted in Durban in 2001 on the elimination of all forms of racism, blah, 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 and xenophobia. And this is a very difficult equation to deal with. But we need to avoid creating legal obligations which can stereotype any foreign working as a person who's been trafficked in, and where we create an obligation in reporting foreigners, possibly legal foreigners. When that was suggested at the time, there was a national outbreak or outrage at the very notion of having people requesting people to report the legal foreigners in the country. And these obviously are illegal foreigners of a special category, but if we're dealing with mere suspicions and we create an obligation on the citizen to report, and we send the citizen to jail if he doesn't, it's a type of environment which, in spite of the hideous nature of the crime, we should not have. And we are not in similar respect of any other crime, where people are required by law to report suspicions of a crime, where we turn the citizens into a policeman, and there is a sanction if he fails to report a suspicion. It's something that doesn't seem to be right.
Mr. Jeffrey,
I wish Dr. Ambrosini would understand our constitution. I mean, he likes referring to citizens. Our constitution does not. You know, it covers South Africans. It's not limited to citizens. Citizens just have a few more rights when it comes to voting, but otherwise it applies to all South Africans. So I wish he wouldn't keep using this term citizens. But it's not citizens. It's a specific category of people: immigration officer, labour inspector, traditional leader, or any other person bound by law, policy, or code prohibiting who suspects or ought reasonably to have known or suspected. They must report, and they report to the police. I don't know what the problem is, you know. It's not as if you call a mass meeting and say there are foreigners here, you know. I mean, really, I don't know what you know. So really, I would urge that we move on. We can look at, I don't know, we're waiting for the document, but we've already started discussing it. Maybe Engela could take us just through the, because it's now being photocopied for those that don't have it, including me. Maybe we could just be given a summary of the gist of what is done in other countries. But you know, this originally it was suspicion, straight suspicion, that's all, that was what was in the bill. Now we've included knowledge, I think, to tighten it. But let's move on.
Jay, no, I'm in agreement with Mr. Jeffries. We've discussed the issue of the suspicion and suspects when we did the definitions at the beginning as well. I think we can go on. The document's not going to help us on this issue. The document relates to the consent of the victim. So I think it's not unheard of in our legislation. We've got in other pieces of legislation, we've got the suspicion as well. We've got your suspected of child abuse. So it's not unknown in our legislation. There are Children's Act as well. There are similar provisions.
All right. Engela, please proceed. Take us through the document. speak to it. Members will get copies as you proceed, but we can't wait for those copies to be provided, and so we'll ask you to speak to the document.
Thank you, Jake. The document, first of all, refers to countries in Africa where we could find law on mandatory reporting. For example, in Zambia, Section 25 of the Anti-Human Trafficking Act of 2008 provides that an immigration officer, labour inspector, social worker, medical practitioner or nurse who has reasonable grounds to believe that a person is a victim shall report to a police officer. And it also extends this duty to say a person who has reasonable grounds to believe that another person is a victim shall report to a police officer. Mozambican law, Articles 8 and 9 of Law Number 6 of 2008 provide that each citizen has the obligation to denounce to the competent authorities the facts that constitute the crimes defined by this in this law, referring them to the trafficking law. Article 9 of the Mozambican Act provides that each immigration services official, customs or border patrol agent, a physician or healthcare agent, or any civil servant which is aware that a person is a victim of trafficking has the special obligation to denounce that fact to the competent authorities. Another African country where there is a duty to report is in Ghana. Section 6 of the Human Trafficking Act of 2005 provides that a person with information about trafficking shall inform the police or may inform the Commission of Human Rights, the Department of Social Welfare, the Legal Aid Board or a reputable civil society organization. We couldn't find in the USA any laws specifically providing for mandatory reporting. Many states of the USA provide in their legislation for trafficking in persons, but not the mandatory reporting thereof. Instead, provision is made for the mandatory reporting by certain professionals and other officials of injuries or abuse of certain persons. We'll just refer to some of the states there. For example, the Florida statute provides a physician, a nurse, or an employee of a hospital or a nursing home who knowingly treats a person suffering from, for example, a gunshot wound or life-threatening injury, which indicate an act of violence, must report that to the sheriff's department. So it is therefore possible that a victim of trafficking might, in these cases, be reported. And then no consent to be reported is required from the victim. Also, for example, in Kentucky, it does not provide for mandatory reporting of a victim of trafficking, but it provides that the victim of trafficking has a privilege to refuse to disclose and to prevent any other person from disclosing confidential communications made to a trafficking victim counselor for the purpose of receiving counseling, therapy services, information, or treatment related to human trafficking. And it is further provided that a human trafficking caseworker shall inform a trafficking victim of any applicable limitations on confidentiality or communications between the victim and the caseworker, and this information may be given orally. I just want to see, because so many of them have similar provisions. And then, of course, many states also have provisions for the reporting of certain medical conditions such as HIV/AIDS, despite the doctor-patient confidentiality, for example, in Alabama, Hawaii, and Kansas. It's also, therefore, possible that the victim of trafficking may, as a result of the provisions of these acts, be reported to the authorities without that victim's consent. In Austria, for example, all punishable offences which are to be prosecuted by law can be reported by any person. And then it says Articles 104A and 207 of the Austrian Criminal Code criminalise trafficking in persons. According to the Austrian physician law, physicians are sworn to secrecy, but all secrets entrusted or made known to them in the execution of the duties, but in case of reasonable suspicion that an act punishable by law has led to the death or serious bodily injury of a person, they are obliged to report this to the police. I could also find in the Taiwan Human Trafficking Prevention and Control Act of 2009 also provides for the mandatory reporting by certain officials. It states the police personnel, immigration officers, labor affairs personnel, social affairs personnel, medical personnel, civil affairs personnel, educational personnel, employees of the tourist industry and immigration service industry, or other personnel engaging in human trafficking prevention and control, must, upon the discovery of a suspected case of human trafficking during the normal course of their duty, immediately notify the local judicial police authority. And the police authority, upon being notified, shall promptly take action to implement relevant protection measures. Also in Egypt, I could find it is mandatory for all to report trafficking in persons, but there are no provisions regarding the consent of a victim to be reported. The Combating Human Trafficking Act reads that imprisonment shall be imposed for a period not less than 6 months and a fine not less than £10,000, not to exceed £20,000, on anyone who has knowledge of the commission of one of the crimes stipulated in this law on dealing with human trafficking, or an attempt to commit such crime and did not notify the competent authority. And if the perpetrator was a public official and the crime occurred in breach of the duties of his job, the maximum imprisonment shall be 5 years. The court may exempt from punishment the person who fails to make a notification if the person was a spouse of the perpetrator, one of his ascendants or descendants, or one of his brothers or sisters.
Okay.
Just as a last remark, Mr. Chairperson, in a submission by the University of Cape Town on the discussion paper on trafficking in persons, they also indicated that a survey of United States, Canadian, Australian, the UK, Spanish and German laws dealing with trafficking in persons, prostitution and immigration showed that those countries do not place positive reporting requirements on those providing professional services.
At the last time, Chair, that we had contacted the embassies through our international relations component to try and get information, particularly about Canada, US, and New Zealand, those countries, because we did manage to get some information on African countries. But what Engel has just now said is sort of a summary of what we've been able to glean from those countries.
Questions for clarity, comments, honourable members?
I think our footnote on page 25 indicates what our view was, and that is that we do not support the requirement of consent by a victim. We did ask for a further clause to be looked at, but that is basically, it seems to be the way that the committee was moving when we deliberated on this previously. And much of the international, in particular the African countries, seem to support that view, that the consent is not, of a victim is not required. So I think, Chair, we pretty much 90% of the way on finalising that.
Mr. Jeffrey?
It seems if the international precedent is not to require consent, then why should we have it? What I'm just not clear about is on page 24 there's a 16(1) and it's amended, and that's limited to effectively government officials. Then on page 25 it's any person. Why are we going so broad?
If my memory serves me correctly, we were asked to do an option. The one, and that was the bill that was introduced, restricts it to certain professions. And then I think it came up very strongly in the public hearings and the comments that this mandatory duty should be thrown open to everyone. And the committee asked us to prepare an option, which we have done. And I think this is one of the issues that the committee hasn't finally decided on either.
Mr. Jeffrey.
No, because I think I prefer it, and it's in a sense responding to Dr. Ambrosini's point, which I moaned about, because I was looking at 16(1). On page 24, I would prefer it being limited to officials and people in authority rather than general members of the public, because it just becomes a bit too blunt then. Whereas this is targeted then at officials who would be coming into contact with potential traffic victims. Otherwise, you sit next to someone on the aeroplane, you suspect that they are being trafficked. There's a duty on you to report it. I know there would be other areas of your landlord or your tenant in a block of flats, and funny things are going on in the flat next door. But we're not particularly far down the line on the duty of ordinary people to report suspicious activity. So I would have preferred it restricted to the government officials.
As opposed to any person.
As opposed to any person, yeah.
Mr. Ambrosini?
Let me just, since you took the time to make the comment, allow me to, just to clarify that when I refer to the citizen, I do it so with the terminology of the French Revolution. The person who is the object of laws.
So just remember where you're in.
Yeah, it's a preferable expression to member of the public, but I will use this awkward expression, member of the public, if that gets through. Better understood by you, Mr. Jeffrey. But I'm just trying to...
Any person.
Okay. I shall do as Mr. Jeffrey demands, Mr. Chairman, from this point on. But again, I want just to bring to your attention that the word knowing is defined in this bill is including should have known. So knowledge is defined as actual knowledge and imputed knowledge. And here we have knows, should have known. So knows, which means imputed knowledge.
Ought,
should have,
ought reasonably to have known.
Yes, but within the definition of knowledge, the ought to have known, it's already including the known. So we have ought to have known, suspected, or ought to have suspected.
Reasonably to have
suspected. Reasonably, yes. again, it's a situation where, you know, hindsight is 20/20 vision. You hear certain noise in the apartment next door, and you don't pay attention, but you should have known that somebody was being beaten up, and it was not the TV. I mean, once somebody ties the dots, everything becomes clear. And in a court of law, it becomes very simple to get the person there and says, you saw that with blood on his nose, you saw that coming in. Now we constantly see thousand things, and we don't tie the dots. And then says, you see, you should have suspected. How could you not? It would have been completely unreasonable. And here you get somebody in trouble just on the ground that he should have reasonably suspected. There is the right to be absent-minded, Mr. Chairman.
So your defense is very easy then?
Well,
in that situation?
No, I mean, there isn't. You're denying the right to be absent-minded.
Yes, but then your defense is very easy then, isn't it?
Which would be
the
what?
The onus on the state to prove your guilt becomes extremely difficult.
You should have known. You should have suspected. A reasonable man would have put that together. And, you see, here there is an obligation on the member of the public to become vigilant,
but
suspicious.
You're assuming that person is already found guilty. The point I'm making is that person will necessarily have to be charged and prosecuted.
Yes.
And in the court of law, you will argue quite comfortably and reasonably that, well, you know, yes, I thought it was a nosebleed.
Yeah, but you should have suspected it was not reasonable. I made my point. More I cannot say.
Sure, Mr. Swart.
Yeah, well, it seems from what Mr. Jeffrey says that it's not going to be every member of public. It's only going to be
those listed yes.
as government officials, but that one does require
yeah.
a higher standard.
So the neighbor in the adjoining flat who hears the screaming and the gunshots or whatever is essentially excluded, am I right, Mr. Swan?
That's correct, yeah, because it would only be an immigration officer, a labor inspector, and those other med persons mentioned under 16.1. It's not any person. And I think the tenor of our discussion is to go along a narrower application.
Yeah.
Precisely because of what Mr. Ambassini says, that concern is then covered, I think.
Yes. Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. That is the approach that we took in the bill as introduced. But just to remind members that the bill was introduced, there was a subclause 2 there that said for what it's worth, any person other than persons referred to in subsection 1A, those are the professionals who on reasonable grounds suspect that an adult person is a victim of may report. So the bill also opens the door for people to report, but you might say, well, that's a pointless provision because anybody can report a crime in any event, but it's put in there because subclause 3 protects those people who make bona fide reports from civil action and so on. I'm just reminding members that's what the bill provided for when it was introduced. Professionals must report and other people may report, and if other people do report, they are protected.
Let's hear Mr. Ambassini and then hear Mr. Swart.
Just a quick concern. When the issue of reporting illegal foreigners emerged in the debate, medical practitioners were specifically excluded in the Immigration Act. Everyone had to report except medical practitioner. And the debate was very clear that the concern was that that one does not want to have people in the situation of not seeking and obtaining medical services in fear of being detected. I'm just raising this because I know that here we're not just dealing with illegal foreigners, we're dealing with a much more serious situation. But because it's much more serious, the fear of being detected becomes even greater because the risk is greater. And we need to make sure that there should be no impairment to anyone receiving the medical assistance he needs.
Mr. Swart.
Just having difficulty following the options. Where does option 2 end? You referred to that clause that was in the bill as tabled, which is, I see, is on page 26
in brackets, is that bold in brackets that means it's been deleted? So where does your option 2
end?
It's 1. So the options are only relating to 1. Is that 1A and B or? It seems that it starts then on 2. Is that correct? On page 26, sub 2 is where your follows on from 16.1 and goes to 16.2 on page 26.
This option 2 is only in respect of sub clause 1.
Only sub clause 1.
Yes.
The whole of sub clause 1.
That's correct.
Okay.
So then it goes on page 26, sub clause 2 is then.
It replaces the old sub 2. Am I correct, Mr. Bassett? Engler?
Yes, that's correct, sir.
Mr. Bassett. And then Mr. Clause 16 has still already got so much, let me call it, that's very cluttered because there are still so many different options on the table.
No, we appreciate that. Yeah. We appreciate that. We're going to clean it up, hopefully now, once we've clarified all our...
Well, Chair, look, it's an attempt to start cleaning, and it is in the context that we have had quite a thorough discussion. We just debated the issue of the medical practitioner before. Unfortunately, not everybody was here. Sorry, you were here?
Yes, sir.
Well, then, if you were here, then why did you repeat yourself today?
No. Come on, let's address the issues.
But, Chair, I think the first question is, do we want this duty to report both knowledge and suspicion to apply to everybody, to any person, or do we want to limit it to particular people?
Yeah.
Because I don't think we have a general, we might have put it into the terrorism legislation, but we generally don't have a general duty to report in our law. I would have therefore been happier with the listed officials. But then I've got a problem with the way that Clause 16.1 on page 24 has been amended, but can I come back to that? Can we get agreement, Chair, on whether this applies, this duty applies to every, this requirement applies to everybody, or whether it's limited to specific officials?
Mr. Swart?
I think, Chair, that makes sense that we make it narrower,
yeah.
Particularly considering there's a suspicion.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, Dr. Ambrosini's concerns in that regard would be to a certain degree then addressed, because it would be narrower.
Okay. Is there anyone that's opposed to that? Can't be, right.
Then, Chair, we're back to 16.1 on page 24.
Right.
And now I do apologize for us, I think, going a bit around in circles. The list in bold of social workers, social service professional, medical practitioners, nurse, traditional health practitioner, traditional healer were deleted. And that's basically all the health people.
Why? Can you recall?
That was on the basis that we I think they were intended to be covered by, because they were bound by a law, policy or code prohibiting the disclosure, that the idea was, okay, you didn't need to list them.
Oh, it says, or any other person.
Yes, that they are then the person bound by this code. But the difficulty is, looking at I don't think it has the desired effect, because you could be, look, we cover attorneys later, but I don't know if I can express myself properly, but you could find an architect or something who's got nothing to do with this, who just happens to come across this knowledge, who's bound by a code, I don't know if they are, and suddenly he or she has a duty to report, whereas in fact what we meant was the medical type practitioners, and we then want to absolve them where they're under the code. We want to require them to report even though they're under the code. So in short, what I'm saying is I actually prefer the original formulation when it came to listing the people, and then reinstating the B no, not bees, about the consent, sorry, not consent, but reinstating the list rather than the way you've got it now. I just think that any other person bound by a law, policy or code prohibiting the disclosure of personal information is too wide. What we're envisaging is the people who professionally come into contact potentially with a trafficked victim.
So what you're saying then is the list of people in bold brackets must be...
Maybe we can just have a motivation. Why do you want it taken out? But that's my...
Mr. Bassett, can you recall?
My colleagues to assist, but I think it was what Mr. Jeffrey mentioned, was we just spoke about people who are under code, and I think we did have in mind more people that deal with on the medical side of things. But I do, and I'll ask my colleagues to assist there, I do note that teachers aren't mentioned here, and I wonder why perhaps they should be mentioned.
Chairperson, I think one of the arguments that we had when we discussed this was that if you're going to specifically list people, then you do run the risk of excluding those that should actually be listed. Perhaps one can try and re-look at a formulation to keep it as it is, but to say, or any other person who in the execution of their duties come into contact with a victim of trafficking and who is bound by a law, etc., then you would still be able to link it to the victim of trafficking.
And still include that list in bold brackets.
She's
proposing, I think, a solution without that list.
Oh, okay.
Because I think, Chair, what they're saying is that the if you have a closed list, then you might have left somebody out. I think it's still debatable, but the proposal of the labour inspector, traditional leader, or any other person who, in the execution of their duties, comes across this
solves it. Okay.
But then I think that the code should be a separate section. It's two stages. We're saying if you are one of these officials and a person who in the course of your official duties comes into contact with a person who potentially could be a victim of trafficking, right, you must report it.
And then
sub two is if you are subject to a code prohibiting that reporting, you must still report it.
Okay. Honourable members, Mr. Ambrosini.
Okay, I'm in favour of listing precisely who are the objects of this obligation. I am in agreement that we need to have a statutory provision, as John said, that exempt them from the application of the code, which would prohibit them to do what we are asking them to do. I'm not in favor of having any language which is inclusive rather than specified, such as not, including but not limited to, because this language, and I need to repeat this when it comes back, this language as it stands, for instance, will undoubtedly apply to journalists, and we would not want that to be the case. If a journalist needs to run a service on trafficking and expose it, I mean, the last thing one can expect them to do is to need to reveal sources or things of that nature, because also here is not clear what it is that the reporting mechanism attaches to. Is it only about the victim? Is it also about the perpetrator? It's also about those who help the perpetrators. I mean, this bill is very wide. So I think we need to list them. And final point, yes, I'm repeating myself, but I feel strongly we must exclude medical practitioner and anyone who provides medical assistance.
Other than the journalists, who else?
Lawyers. I mean, I don't know. Psychologists.
That's precisely what we're saying. Any person bound by a law, policy, or code.
Yeah, and the journalists and psychologists are bound.
You know, and we are saying we're notwithstanding that. This is a victim of trafficking.
there are two aspects here, and first of this. This sentence is collapsing the things. One is exempting people from the obligation to keep their mouth shut. And the other one is the obligation to speak up. They're separate. And we are exempting them from the application of the code, and we are telling them that they need to go the extra step. It's not a may, it becomes a must. They must report it.
What are they reporting, Mr. Emerson?
I don't know, you tell me.
It says there that an adult person is a victim of trafficking. That's what they're reporting. They're not required to report that it's Llewellyn Landers who is the trafficker. All the journalist is required to report is that I suspect that Mr. J.B. Sibanyoni has been trafficked. Of course, the journalist knows who is the trafficker, who is perpetrating it. And there he can protect his sources. Same thing. All you're doing is telling the police that you suspect that person is the victim of trafficking.
What about the argument that would prevent the victim of trafficking from the law to the medical practitioner?
Well, the victim is already there.
Yeah, but
how else does the medical practitioner know that?
There, but the chilling effect of this provision is going to be that once this provision is there, people will be screened the victim of trafficking to the doctors because they.
Let me make this clear. Whoever is in this hideous business of trafficking people will know this legislation.
Sure.
Will try to fly under the radar. So there is so much, the stakes are so high, 20 years of prison, that the last thing we'll know is to go where he knows it's going to be detected. So we are telling the perpetrator never to bring a victim of trafficking to a hospital.
Okay, what about someone who is not the perpetrator, who comes across this person that requires medical assistance and then takes that person to a hospital or medical practitioner?
See, under those conditions, there is no problem, because then the victim of trafficking is somehow free.
I don't expect the perpetrator to take his trafficking victim to hospital. I mean, he's going to try his level best not to do that under normal circumstances.
Yeah, I think we've dealt with this at length, and as I've indicated before, it's not without precedent in our law.
Sure.
As far as a medical person is involved, and I think that we need to move on. As far as the legal issue, the lawyers is concerned, there is a specific exemption for that. Mm-hmm. So that will not apply to breach legal privilege, and I think we've covered the bases, and I think we've had extensive discussions on this issue. I'm not persuaded to exclude medical practitioners, and I think we should move on.
Just quickly, I mean, I see on the international example that America requires reports. I mean, it's not specifically on trafficking, but on abuse.
Yes.
So that's in America. So
it's obligatory.
It's obligatory.
I think we lose a lot. I think the medical practitioners are, just by virtue of their job, they're the ones that are going to come across this the most.
All right.
May I just get clarity on what we're going to do? I understand we're going to have a new subsection 2, new subclause 2, and that's going to deal with even if words to the effect that even if you are subject to a code or policy, you must still report. Subsection 1, I got lost along the way that Mr. Jeffries mentioned, are we going to mention the professionals that are there and include any other person, or just help me again, sorry.
I don't know.
There was one proposal from Ms. Steelman, she was motivating for an open list on the basis if you list people and you forget someone. Dr. Ambrosini was motivating for the closed list. And I don't know, we've got to come up with a position. Personally, I think, and I know we would have debated it, so it is going around a bit in circle. Personally, because it's quite a heavy duty, I would rather have the closed list. I know you say you've left out teachers, but I mean, a teacher is unlikely, I mean, the trafficking victim is unlikely to be going to school. So, I don't know, I don't feel particularly strongly about it. I mean, Chair, we obviously don't have any party position on it. But it's more just you want to, where you have a sort of wide onerous requirement, you do want to limit it. So, and I mean, it is the closed list that came to us from the Law Commission. So Ms. Steedman may have fought a battle for an open list in the Law Commission and lost it. I don't know, maybe that's being unfair. I think, Chair, the issue we've got is, do we want to specify people, or do we want the option that Ms. Steedman is putting, which would be listing some, and then it's any other person who, in the course of their official duties, comes into contact with a possible traffic victim.
Why don't we ask them to do two options for us?
So, Chair, what we've now got then is two options on 16.1. There will be a new 16.2, which is the issue of if you're bound by a code, you're exempted. And then the consent issue falls away.
Yeah.
So the old two,
which is consent, falls away.
That's right.
You may want to...
Chair, you may want to link... Well, look, I see the existing three is about exempting liability. You're not liable to civil action if you made the report in good faith. Maybe the code issue, the exemption from your code, maybe could come under three.
Because it's basically
the consequences of your reporting. You're not liable. You're not liable for. You haven't broken your code, and you also can't be sued.
Isn't that covered by disciplinary action?
Chair, I do think it would be useful to specifically have the codes not applying, because you're a doctor, you see this person, you're then not sure and you don't report it. And you say afterwards, no, you were worried that it was in violation of your code. Is it not part of the Hippocratic Oath? So I don't know. I just think it's safer to have, to specifically, as we've done, to exempt those subject to the code.
How about saying no, not subject to disciplinary action in terms of any professional code or otherwise?
Can you look at that, Mr. Bassett?
Does that then effectively mean that the subclause 2 that Mr. Jeffrey was suggesting will fall away because it will be dealt with in subclause 3?
Yes. And that effectively removes all the footnotes on page 25, Mr. Bassett.
That's to be the case, yes, Chair.
Yes. Our discussions.
Yeah, there is So yes, options 1 and 2 would fall away totally.
Yes.
And the original subclause 2, we're not going to keep.
That's right.
The original subclause 2 says that any person may still report even if you don't fall into that category. Mm. Does the committee want to bring that back, revive it? That fell off because at one stage everyone, the committee was of the view that everyone should possibly report. But subclause 2 of the bill on page 26 in square brackets says any person other than a professional who suspects that an adult person is a victim of trafficking may report.
So it's optional.
So it allows the man in the street,
yes,
to report. And the question might arise, is it necessary, because they can report, but it does, subclause 3 that we've just discussed, does give that person some protection from civil liability.
Do we keep, honourable members, the original sub 2 in bold brackets, or do we remove it?
Gee, I don't know. I don't think it does any harm to retain it, because that might cover the issue of a teacher that's not specifically mentioned. It might just remind that person that there's no obligation, but they are able to, and then the teacher would also have that benefit of the protection in terms of a code under sub 3. So I don't think it makes any harm. It does any harm. It obviously it depends on which option we follow under 16.1. Have we got clarity now? I think Mr. Jeffries was out, so you just might want to just remember, are we now specifying only the categories under 16.1?
I think it was decided that we prepare two options, a closed list and yeah, okay. Under 16.1.
I don't think that sub 2, as it was as introduced, does any harm in including it.
Mr. Jeffrey?
I mean, Mr. Bassett, I thought he'd explained earlier, sorry for being in and out, but this is something else I was having to attend to. I thought he'd explained earlier why we needed to, that although on the face of it, it is it's pointless, but in fact, because of 3,
yeah,
it provides protection. So it's not just not doing any harm, it's actually doing some good.
Yeah, so we leave it in.
Yeah.
Bring it back in, I beg your pardon. All right.
Just on the way forward, for clarity purposes, Chair, the subclause 2 that's underlined on page 26 that deals with legal professional privilege, I presume that is going to stay.
Subclause 4 is presumably because we don't trust the police, so we want to set out what they must do. I mean, look, on the face of it, it's really something that should be in regulations, but if we want to put it in, because, you know, the wording was you report it to the police, full stop, okay, whereas what we've got here on page, particularly on page 27, well, no, it's actually more detail, I suppose, yeah. It's more than just the police. But it's just really a question of again, this is, I suppose, why when we keep reinventing things. We presumably felt that it wasn't clear enough what happens once you've reported it. There is the provision of being able to enter premises under A1, which I suppose is necessary. And then there's protective custody. Now, I suppose I withdraw.
Now, these were issues I thought that were clarified with the committee on a previous occasion, and I think these came out, were inserted as a result of discussions that we had with SAPS. Yeah, may we resume then? Thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Jay. On page 27, footnote 80, I think we've just dealt with it. It was as a result of discussions between the police and social development. B reads, must within 24 hours refer the person to an accredited organization and notify the provincial department of social development of that person. And then you will see footnote 81. Excuse me. There we are suggesting that the committee might wish to reconsider this provision, that the police should refer the person to an accredited organization and notify the provincial department, instead maybe providing that the police can refer the person to both an accredited organization or the provincial department of social development. The reason for this was the offices of the provincial department of social development might be nearer to where the victim is than a accredited organization, and therefore it might be easier also for the police to take that person to the offices of the provincial department, the district office for instance. So that is just maybe something that the committee would like to consider.
Honourable members?
What is the specific suggestion?
That the police must be allowed leeway, Mr. Swart. As they pointed out, sometimes these accredited organizations are as much as 300 kilometers away from the police station. And in that case, it's requiring a lot of their resources to put the victim into a vehicle and drive them all that way, whereas they could be allowed to contact social development, who would then be required to take the necessary steps. Mr. Jeffrey.
I don't know if, I mean, it is important, but what does refer mean? You refer the person to an accredited organization. So Mr. Swart is the traffic victim, and I say go to this or that accredited organization. Isn't that purely what it means? And then it's in notify the Department of Provincial Development, I mean Social Development. Then I can keep Mr. Swart in the in temporary safe care station pending his transfer to the accredited organization. And then under six, if it's reasonably possible to do so, this is the driving 300 kilometers, give assistance including transporting, if it's reasonably possible to do so. But I think the issue is, I'm really raising, is it an issue? It's not, it is a referral. Does a referral mean that it doesn't mean that you physically got to take? Hence, you've got six, which is the Geldenaes clause, which is basically, if it's reasonably possible to do so, then you transport them. I mean, Geldenaes from the police. So I think it reads fine at the moment, because my reading of refer is not that you physically have to take the person. So you say to refer for me would be, Mr. Swart, you're a victim of trafficking, go to this or that. We are sitting in Porfada, go to this or that accredited organization in Kimberley. And then I inform the Northern Cape Department. Then the issue of how Mr. Swart gets to Kimberley is covered by six. And it's not hard and fast. It's reasonably possible.
Honourable Debbie Schaefer?
I think that's right. But what concerns me now when they're looking at it is that they are not obliged to assist in getting medical treatment. I understand and accept that they shouldn't be obliged unnecessarily to transport them long distances, but surely if they need medical treatment, they should be obliged to get it for them.
Sorry,
says must. Though.
Must if reasonably possible.
If reasonably possible.
I think it's fine.
That's fine.
We didn't hear that.
Must it reasonably possible?
Well, according to you, and if someone needs medical attention, then they need it.
The problem is that, you know,
I have a cold. I feel sick. I don't, you know, I need medical attention, but I, you know, they mustn't go like dropping everything to transport me. Obviously I've been shot and I'm like bleeding, then that's different. But it's, but I, you know,
look,
I just do think that the shampoo analogy is a good one. I do think it's splitting hairs.
Well, you must decide, honourable members.
I mean, I don't think that Mr. Jeffrey deserves anyone agreeing with him, because he's really acting in a very terrible manner, but I do agree with him.
I think we understand your qualification.
not on the shampoo, on the
And I'm pretty sure that when you agree with him, he's terribly embarrassed.
To see, maybe the directives or the national instructions cover something like that.
Yeah, is that. Look, we accept that, you know, our police are not the best in the world, not that the others are pretty far ahead of them. Sure, we acknowledge that. So what do we do when a traffic victim staggers into the police station? That's it. We have to rely on them.
They must take them for medical attention if reasonably possible.
Yeah, if it's a shotgun, if it's a shotgun wound, well, yes, they must.
Presumably, yeah, the reasonable possibility would be linked to how bad medical condition.
And if it's a hacking cough that indicates flu, well, what does the policeman do?
I'm not worried about that. Well, that requires medical attention.
Okay, maybe it was urgent medical attention.
Let's put a definition of medical attention.
I would be interested to know if it's covered by the directives, because
it
might.
I think it's fine as it is. It's
not specifically covered by the directives, but isn't there a general obligation that the policeman who arrests any person or to make sure that here we're talking about a victim.
All right, let's move on.
On page 28 of the document, it actually starts on page 27, subclause 7, provides the Provincial Department of Social Development, which has been notified as provided for in subsection 4B, or to which an adult person has been referred to as provided for, in section 19.2b, there's footnote 82, that is an amendment in line with a suggestion by the committee on 6 September, that prosecutors should refer the matter to the provincial department, which will then make arrangements for the person to be admitted to an accredited organization. So the reference is there to section 19.2b. Can I proceed, Mr. Chair?
All right, there's no comment, so that indicates you may proceed.
With regard to footnote 83, that is something that has been dealt with. It is just to explain that the provisions in subclause 6 have been moved to the new subclause 11, which I will come to later. With regard to subclause 9, the word it has been deleted. You will see footnote 84, that was as agreed to on 6th of September. The committee indicated during the last meeting in September that clause 16 is too long and that it should be divided. So what we have done is to put subclause 11, 12 and 13 dealing with appeals in a standalone clause, which is currently clause 16, capital A. So I think I will deal then with those provisions when you get to clause 16A. Coming to the new subclause 11, previously 14, that is the old subclause 6, dealing with the temporary accommodation of a victim of trafficking. And you will then also note that it is... the committee requested on 6 September that we should amend the clause. To be dealt with, the question was also raised whether this provision should not be amended to accommodate the person who is required for purposes of giving evidence in any court proceedings. We feel that this subclause deals with temporary accommodation whilst the letter of recognition is awaited. If a person is found to be a victim of trafficking, he or she will in any event be entitled to the programs, which will then include accommodation at an accredited organization. Food clause 91.
Yes. Will obviously depend on the discussions with Home Affairs on this reflection period, and so we can't sign that off now, I presume. What is the position with Home Affairs, Chair?
I think we should ask Home Affairs that when we get them here, because as Mr. Bassett pointed out last week, he'd much prefer that they speak for themselves because he hasn't had the best of engagements with them.
That was what I meant with my question. Will they be able to attend? Will they be attending tomorrow? And is there the required cooperation from their side? And do we not need to escalate the matter and discuss it with the minister, Chair? Maybe Mr. Bassett can tell us how he's progressed in that regard.
Well, I think it's for us to get Home Affairs here. That's myself, Mr. Romano, and the committee. I don't think it's Mr. Bassett's responsibility to get Home Affairs here. I mean, he can make the request, but if they say, well, we're too busy, then there's little or nothing he can do. So that is the way we'll try to do it, failing which then we'll have to go directly to the minister herself and just inform her that, as per her request, we are struggling to get her officials to come to this committee. And then she can instruct them to be here. Because the point was, we're dealing with people who will say to Mr. Bassett, as regards that, I'm not in a position to give you an answer, which doesn't help anybody.
Yeah. Chair, I think we've got the police and the NPA tomorrow.
Short notice.
Well, I was just saying that I had invited them for today, but they indicated that they had another meeting in Parliament. So I propose that they come tomorrow. I'm still waiting for their response.
All right.
You've got the NPA in the office.
Yeah. Chair, if I may just understand, if we just in general terms, that besides the issue of the Cabinet involvement of Home Affairs, this process has come from the Law Commission. From 2004, it's now 7 years, that Home Affairs has been part of that process right from the word go as well. So we appreciate things develop and there are interventions, but it's an It's not like the Home Affairs haven't been involved from word go, which is now almost 7 years. So just to alert you to that, I'm sure you're aware of that as well, Chair. Thank you.
No, we are, and I think it's because of that that the Minister undertook the initiative that she did to contact me and raise her concerns. So, I think in fairness we should try and get the relevant officials here, and if they having difficulties, then we'll contact the Minister and say, look, you know, we need your officials. Mr. Jeffrey?
I was going to say, Chairman,
I would suggest we don't carry on this item. I mean, the reference is just simply under 9B, inform them of a recovery period, which obviously we can come back to if they're a foreigner, but the rest doesn't relate to being a foreigner.
Yes.
If you can just go back to footnote 90, I see I've omitted there. Footnote 90, it refers there to paragraph B, but I think it should be C. It's a new option.
Yes, I see what you mean there. Okay.
It's a new option for consideration by the committee pursuant to discussions on 6 September when it was indicated that a person must also be accommodated temporarily for the 14-day period during which he or she has to lodge an appeal.
It was, in fact, a request of the committee.
Coming to footnote 91, this is just to indicate that the subclause is intended to replace subclause 6 of the introduced bill, which is the one dealing with it being temporary accommodation. On page 30, footnote 92, on 6 September, the committee indicated that a police official should not be subject to a criminal sanction, and therefore the reference to subsection 4B was deleted.
There's some options regarding this this sub-clause, but I think it all depends on the options that we're going to prepare for sub-clause 1 that the committee's asked us today to deal with. So sub-clause 12 will have to be aligned with how sub-clause 1 of this provision reads at the end of the day and what decision the committee decides.
Coming to the new clause 16A, appeals against decision of the provincial head, that deals with the previous clauses 11, 12 and 13. Footnote 100 has been deleted as agreed on the 6th of September to refer to the provincial. If the provincial head is not satisfied that the person is a victim of trafficking or withdraws a letter of recognition in terms of section 1610, that provincial head must provide written reasons. Originally we referred to the provincial department of social development. So
what are we doing with these range of options, three options on page 30?
Chair, that's what I indicated. I think the options, what subclause 12 is eventually going to look like, will depend on what the committee decides for subclause 1. For subclause 1, the committee asked us just now to do two options, a closed list and an open list. So I think at the end of the day, subclause 12 is going to, there's going to be a penalty, it's a penalty provision for the people that are referred to in subclause 1.
Well, I don't know why we need options, because you will just refer to the people.
Yes, sure. Okay.
You don't have to list them. So if we do go for the option of the closed list, then those are the people referred to in subclause 1. And if we go for an open list, well, they're also the people we referred to in subclause 1. So is it not is it not option 2?
Yeah, it would be makes sense, Mr. Bassett.
That's correct. Sorry, I didn't see that one, but that's what it
is. Option 1 and option 3 can
fall away.
Fall away.
All right. Honourable members?
Mm.
Okay, good.
And then I think there is agreement around on Ms. Schaefer's, you know, we reluctantly agreed to Ms. Schaefer's provision. So I think that footnote 95 can also come out together with the striking out.
Just don't go to the nearest police station. Well, as you walk in, remember the magic words. Do you know who I am? Oh, yes, we've heard about you. Oh, goodness. Yeah.
Proceed, sir.
Yes.
We can just go back to clause 16A. 16A.
Yes, on page 31.
That's correct. Paragraph A. It reads that the provincial head must provide written reasons to the person affected by his or her decision. And then in paragraph B, we have amended the words a person aggrieved by the decision. We have changed it to the person affected by to be in line with what is reflected in paragraph A. I think as it reads, a person aggrieved by, it might also relate to somebody else who will be able to appeal. In subclause 2, the MEC must, within 30 days of the appeal being lodged, I think the word that the committee decided upon was finalized, as you will see in footnote 103. In subclause 3, if the appeal is unsuccessful or the affected person does not lodge an appeal or there is an alternative or if no appeal is lodged, the committee must still decide there on what the correct wording should be.
That's the accredited organization or provincial department.
Now whether the words the affected person does not lodge an appeal
or
if no appeal is lodged.
Why we've got that provision. The person has been found not to be a victim of trafficking.
Right.
And they've decided not to appeal or they lost the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
They must go. Why do we need regulations? That's all. Well, they will no longer be supported by the by the accredited organization.
That's right.
Well, no further state support will be given. I mean, it's obvious.
Yes.
Yeah, I think my colleagues must help me, but I think this came as a result of discussions with DST, and they requested it. But I tend to agree with the sentiments being expressed.
I don't even know if you need the clause,
because it basically is this they fall outside this act.
Say, for example, if this person, you realize this person is an illegal immigrant who falsely claimed to be a victim of trafficking, are you just going to let this person go into the country, or are you going to follow a process where this person will actually be referred to Home Affairs in order to be deported? So we need to keep that in mind.
That's what we want. It can't just be left to walk around. It just doesn't work.
Okay, no, then I suppose there's a reason.
Yeah.
But I just didn't want this sort of thing of shame in making.
No, there will be those, but. Yeah. Are we clear, Phil? Yes, yeah. They must be referred to Home Affairs, and those laws kick in, obviously.
But again, I don't know why you
need regulation. It would be basically those internal people, the accredited organization can do what they like with them, but there's no more state support. The foreigners need to be reported to Home Affairs. What other categories are there?
Well, the domestics, the locals, there's no problem. You know, they're just not victims, and that's that. It's the foreigners that we will need to think carefully about. In that case, the relevant official must refer them to Home Affairs.
Then why do we have that supervision?
Because, I mean, you've got two categories. You've got locals, you've got foreigners. The locals are not victims of trafficking, so I don't know if you need to say anything.
No.
But then with a foreigner who alleged to be a victim of trafficking, if they're illegal, they must be referred to, if they're not in the country legally, they must be referred to Home Affairs immediately.
That's right.
So I don't know why it needs to have regulation. I mean, maybe you can just take that back to DSD who wanted this, and see. But it's not as if there's a huge range of possibilities that it would be best to say let it be dealt with in regulation. It just seems to me to be one case, and that's illegal foreigners.
Yeah.
Conceivably could be a legal foreigner.
Sure.
I mean, somebody can't stay in the study permit, becomes a victim of trafficking, then is taken out of it on account of drugs, on account of something else, that's taken out of the situation of trafficking, put back into school.
Well, in that case, they lodge an appeal.
Yeah, because
Cambrosini was out. This is people who have been found not to be victims of trafficking.
I understand.
Yes. That's it.
So
maybe
he could have a valid.
Yes, if there's a valid reason to be in the country and he's a foreigner.
Yes, I mean, it's not any foreigner.
It's foreigners who do not have the necessary, who are in the country illegally. So it's specifically that. I mean, you don't have to go report every Greek, Italian.
He said Greek too,
by the way. I mean, we should fit. I don't like the petition for just walking again.
All right, Mr. Bassett, Engler, you've got that then.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. And again, these footnotes all come out?
Yes.
Good.
On page 31, footnote 107, it's just to indicate that this clause was not discussed, and I suppose it will also stand over for the discussions with the Department of Home Affairs. That is the whole clause.
Option one and
option one in respect of subclause 3 deals with the instance where a child has been trafficked and has reached the age of 18 years. And what will then happen to that child? That is an illegal foreign child, of course.
what happens to that child normally in terms of the Refugees Act.
But Chase, sorry, I thought we were leaving this one for Foreign Affairs. It's related to them. So is there any point in discussing it?
Should we not wait for them to be here?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. All right, let's flag this one and let it stand over until Home Affairs are here.
DJ. Proceeding to clause 18, the provision of healthcare services. You will see footnote 113. We added subclause 2, subsection 1 also applies in respect of a foreign child or adult person who is suspected of being a victim of trafficking. An adult person who has lodged an appeal is provided for in section 16A1B, or an adult person in terms of whom the 14-day period as provided for in section 16A1B has not yet expired. I don't know if Ms. Williams would like to come in here, because they raised a concern regarding the constitutionality of this provision.
Subsection 1, foreigner who is a victim of trafficking is entitled, right? All right, so Ms. Williams, help us here. What should we say then?
Okay. My concern was simply that the Constitution affords everyone the right to healthcare services, and I think the manner in which it's stated, it creates categories of people, so it, to avoid unforeseen or unintended consequences, I suggest if the committee feels strongly about putting it in the bill, to restate what the Constitution says in the Bill of Rights, alternatively to leave it out of the bill. But the minute you create categories, it could create unforeseen or unintended consequences of excluding certain people from those provisions in the Bill of Rights.
Honourable members.
Do we really need sub 2? Because it just says that they are all entitled to medical treatment. Sub 2 embroiders it. It doesn't deny any medical treatment or healthcare services. So firstly the question is, do we need sub 2? But the benefit of it states that even if you're subject to an appeal, or you're suspected of being a victim of trafficking, or that period is not expired, you're still entitled to the healthcare services. So there's nothing there that denies you the constitutional right to health services. How, maybe Ms. Williams can just explain how that sub 2 could be interpreted to limit the access to healthcare as set out in the Constitution. If that's a legitimate concern, then one could delete sub 2 totally.
I understand the point. I mean, sub 2 lists people who it also applies to, which means there are others to whom it doesn't apply to. And what she is saying is that, well, the Constitution applies to everybody. And that's to Dr. Ambrosini's citizens, French citizens, and non-citizens. I would support Mr. Swart. I mean, why don't we just have it as it was? Foreigners entitled to the same, and make a cross-reference to section whatever the Constitution. I agree it's an unnecessary clause, but I think Palermo specifically places an obligation to provide health services.
Yeah.
So just to make those people reading the bill on its own without looking at the Constitution, but would it not, could we not deal with it by basically keeping as it was, but just making as provided for in section whatever of the Constitution, and delete sub 2?
I think I'd agree with that too.
All right, so sub 2 comes out, and then a reference to the Constitution must be put in sub 1. Okay?
Just before we delete that footnote 112, the last sentence of that might
require a reference in our report where it says the Department of Health agrees that either the Refugees Act or the Immigration Act should address the access of public health services by illegal foreigners. So that obviously appears there is a deficiency there. I think one of the practical problems was an illegal foreigner that doesn't have a form of identification can't open a medical file to get access to medical treatment.
Well, that applies to anybody.
Yeah.
If you go to a state hospital without your ID, you're in trouble.
I'm assuming that's the one problem. There might be other practical problems. Do we need to, before we delete 112, do we need to say anything about that at some stage?
Mr. Chairman, the matter here is a little more complex and basically works, as I understand it, this way. The Constitution extends human rights to people by virtue of their being human. So the provisions of those human rights, including the right to health, education, etc., cannot be discriminated between citizens and non-citizens, legal foreigners and illegal foreigners. Illegal foreigners have got the same measure of right, of a provision, of right to access those services. However, the Immigration Act tried to push the envelope as far as it could to the constitutional boundary, and while recognizing that illegal foreigners have the right to access those services, and while recognizing saying that the health services, education cannot deny services on account of people being illegal, empowers the minister to issue regulations which require those facilities to ascertain the status of people. So you ascertain the status and you give them a service with a view to reporting them. And that goes again to the chilling effect that people may not send their children to school if they know that they're going to be reported. This is the difficulty of balancing our interests. There is no possibility of withholding the service, but they have a legal obligation to schools to ascertain that they are in the country legally while they provide the service. That's about the Immigration Act. The Refugee Act is a completely different story. They have a status. The people have a status under the Refugee Act. Either they are asylum seekers or they are refugees. These are the only two statuses. And under those two statuses, they can work, they can study until the conditions in their countries of origin have been transformed to the point that they can be repatriated there.
Take your hands up, Mr. Jeffrey. Okay. All right, it's one of those difficult situations. Issue of the century.
Yeah. The chair, it's fine as it is. I mean, you know, as Mr. Swart said, we were going to report. I don't know what we need to put into the report.
All right. Okay. That takes us to page 34.
That's great.
No, please proceed.
Do we keep that footnote in then?
Do we keep that footnote, 112, the last sentence that Mr. Swart referred to? As a way of a reminder.
Possibly for report. Just see the director at the end. Or if it's got nothing to do with us, then we have.
Let's leave it up.
Delete it then.
Yes, delete it all together. Yeah.
Clause 19 deals with the criminal prosecution of the victim of trafficking. On page 34, footnote 114, the committee decided on or suggested on the 6th of September that a prosecutor will believe that the person that he's charging is a victim of trafficking. That prosecutor must refer in a prescribed manner the child and the adult person to the provincial department of social development. And so we've taken out the words refer the child to a designated child protection organization so that the victims will then be referred to a provincial department of social development, which will then be able to deal with the victim of trafficking with regard to the assessing of that victim. With regard to footnote 115, that is our suggestion that we combine paragraphs B and C, which we think will just make for better reading.
The power remains with the prosecutor. If you remember, the wording in the bill was horrible. Once they had the certificate, they couldn't be prosecuted. And then consideration must be given to whether the offence was committed as a direct result of the person's position. So it doesn't mean that any victim of trafficking has immunity from prosecution for anything. My slight uncomfortableness with two is that if the prosecutor suspects on reasonable grounds that the person is a victim of trafficking, they must apply to court for a postponement. And I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the peremptory nature of the must, because it could be an unrelated thing. So I think it's correct that they must, in the prescribed manner, refer the person. But well, may then becomes, it would depend on this. I would really feel it would depend on the circumstances whether they should get a postponement. So it would be they may, if they believe that the crime may relate to them being, I mean, sort of linking it to one, you know, if they believe, if they on reasonable grounds believe that the, if during the proceedings of a person, the prosecutor suspects that the person is a victim of trafficking, that the thing is linked to the crime is linked as a direct result of the person's position, then they must postpone. But it's only if they think the crime is linked, and then they must refer them if they think they're a victim of trafficking, whatever the crime is, they must refer it to social development. So I don't know if that's making sense, but I just want to avoid a situation where it's a completely unrelated crime and suddenly this case has to stop to follow a procedure that's not linked. I don't know if anybody else shares my concern.
It happens. Okay. I thought we would stop at clause 20 on the next page.
That's why she was
late. So he was nine.
Yes, please. Subclause 2B, page 34, subclause 2B, footnote 116. We've just deleted the words in a prescribed manner, as they are also found in at the beginning of that sentence in a prescribed manner. So it was just a duplication.
Yes.
Does it only need that must in the beginning of that, or B? You're going to say may apply for the permanent must in the prescribed manner.
No, sorry. What I was saying was that the must remains.
But it is linked to the postponement is linked to whether the case is whether the offence may have been committed. There's reasonable grounds for believing that the offence was committed as a direct result of the person's position. So in those circumstances, you must postpone and you must refer the person. Well, you must refer the person. Any. If a prosecutor comes across a suspected victim of trafficking, they must. You might have to divide it up. They must refer them, okay, to social development, because even if it's an unrelated case, there might be other things that come up, evidence that can implicate people in trafficking, that kind of thing. So you must refer it, and then the postponement issue would only be. It would also be a must, not a may. And it would only be where you think there's reasonable grounds to suspect that the offence is as a result of a person's was committed as a result of the person's position as a victim. Because the referral would apply to any person who the prosecutor reasonably suspects of being a victim of trafficking, you might want to have that as one section, because that applies to every victim of trafficking the prosecutor comes across, but the postponement only applies to where they think the case may be as a result of the person's position as a victim.
You're saying we should have two separate standalone clauses, possibly?
It may be easier because they don't relate. The one relates to all trafficking victims, the other only relates to those where the case is a bearing.
Yes.
Still on page 34, subclause 2C, footnote 117, was also at the request of the committee that the prosecutor must refer that person to the an accredited organization or to the provincial department. He will only now refer that person to the provincial department. But you will notice that the whole of C has been deleted because we have combined B and C.
Oh, okay. I was about to ask that.
Subclause 3 provides that a letter of recognition that an adult person is a victim of trafficking or a finding by the Provincial Department of Social Development after an assessment referred to in section 15(6) that a child is a victim of trafficking serves as a ground for the withdrawal of the criminal prosecution or the discharge of the victim of trafficking if the prosecutor is satisfied that the offence was committed as a direct result of the person's position as a victim of trafficking. We initially formulated an option in respect of subclause 3. You will note there's footnote 118, which we thought would make for easier reading, but we have, just before we began, we've discussed it, and because it reads a finding by the provincial department after an assessment referred to in section 15(6) that the child is a victim of trafficking or referred to in section 16(7) that an adult person is a victim of trafficking serves as a ground for withdrawal or discharge of the victim. But the adult victim of trafficking must be issued with a letter of recognition, and that is not reflected in this option of subclause 3. So we can either redraft the option, or the committee might decide to stay with the current clause, the 3 as it reads.
The committee didn't ask for this option, we just put it in, and perhaps it would be best to withdraw our suggestion because it isn't working in all respects.
All right. Honourable members, have we agreed to that?
Agreed,
yeah. Right, so the option comes out. And all the footnotes on that page, those fall away too?
Fall away.
Good, excellent. Right, clause 20, the Honourable Debbie Schaefer's.
Mr. Chairperson, I can then say with regard to clause 20, there is no other amendments or suggestions by the committee that we needed to attend to, so that is, there's nothing on clause 20.
Clause 20, may I address you? I did a whole lot of preparation on this, and this needed about a 10-page document if I can.
You see, Mr. Ambrosini, it's not just you that's targeted. But unlike you, the Honorable Debbie Schaefer sees the funny side. All right. Honorable members, that being the case, let's take a, what shall it be, 15-minute break? 10-minute break. Okay, thank you. 25 past. We're back.
Yeah, No, no. I was amazing. Losing them, you never forget. I remember I was working as a young man in Greece in a town called Tandi, northern Zulu town. And my hometown was in Frey.
Okay.
About 60 kilometers in Fiji. So every weekend I would get into my car, drive home, see my mother. My father had gone to retire. Now one funny weekend I drove on a Friday to go and see my mother. Halfway home, Friday, my mother's no more.
I'm
glad to hear that.
I've
got a daughter, Washadela Pinukase.
Oh, okay.
She's Mrs. Kajwa.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm a suburb somewhere. I'm flying part of the Kulwa. My grandchildren and all that. I'm Washadela and Dr.
Yes.
Didn't say my respect, man.
No. I was born in Italy.
And then you went to New York.
And then I grew up in Newcastle.
Where about in New York?
Edendale Hospital.
I was born at home those days.
Uh-huh.
Our mothers didn't take us to hospital.
But Mama, you know, where was it called?
Oh, very corpus, they say.
Okay, honorable members, we're back. Ms. Stain, we're now on clause 21. But your footnote says this entire chapter was not discussed.
Chair,
and yes.
This is the issue of kind of affairs.
Yeah.
We're dealing with, I think, tomorrow they come or with the talks and things. So I would suggest that we move to
the next chapter.
Chapter 5, yeah, 29. And then I think there is another chapter later.
That falls in the same category.
Relating to, it's chapter 7, return and repatriation. We're leaving
chapter 4,
and Chair suggests we go to chapter 5 then.
Agreed, honourable members?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, coming to chapter 5, which deals with the accreditation of organisations to provide services to adult victims of trafficking, we don't have any footnotes on page 39 dealing with this chapter, or on page 40. On page 41, in footnote 134, subclause 4 there is the clause 26 of the introduced bill, which deals with the information management. The committee on 23 August requested that we should possibly move this chapter to the chapter dealing with the administration of the Act. But we suggest that in view of that the clause in question deals with information by an accredited organization, that it rather be inserted in this clause. So that it will also fall under the norms and minimum standards. that an accredited organization must comply with.
I think this was sort of accepted now on a previous occasion. So I just want to point out the subclause 4 now in a new place, and I think the footnote says as much. Although it's in a new place, we haven't underlined it so that the committee can get an indication of what the changes are to that clause as it was introduced into Parliament. But strictly speaking, I suppose it should be underlined because it's been moved from one place to another. I just thought I'd bring that to your attention.
Thank you.
Chairperson, with regard to clause 26, we don't have any footnotes relating to that. Coming to page 43, clause 27, access to program offered by an accredited organization, footnote 135, there's just an amendment as agreed to in the committee on 6th of September, that the person who has been issued with a letter of recognition is entitled to access to a program offered by an accredited organization. We've deleted the words "or a person referred to in section 1614, which at that stage dealt with appeals.
So what are these programs that are being referred to? And why do we need to put it in the law? Oh, I see. Must offer a program. I see. Okay. Provision of accommodation.
Chair, these are things I think in terms of Palermo, which not everybody here supports, but I think generally the country does. Everybody here supports, but not all members of the committee, apparently. But I think that's why it is there. We have to provide for it. Then we have to then make the link in terms of the certified victim or the recognized victim. And then the change that we wanted was that we did not want persons who have not yet been... this provision, I think, for people on appeal to get accommodation. But we don't want the appellants to access the program because they've been already refused. So the chances are they're having a second bite. There wasn't a right of appeal before. Once they get in, and the appeal process has to be settled within 30 days, so it was more just to say, look, they can't start these programs relating to counseling and therapeutic stuff until an education, until they've been certified. So that's basically the change. Or whatever the you know, refer, what's issued. They've been issued. These people that are issued.
All right.
Clause 28, a plan to address needs of victim of trafficking. You will see in footnote 136, subclause 2 is new and is intended to give effect to the committee's discussion on this matter on 6th of September. If I can remember correctly, the discussion was about the inclusion of an exit plan, and that has been amended accordingly. The committee also made mention of a victim who was needed as a witness in court. We are of the view, if a victim of trafficking is needed as a witness in court, he or she will in any event be entitled to access the programs to be provided by accredited organizations, which will include accommodation. And there appears to be no need then to make additional provision for a victim who is needed as a witness. Can I proceed?
Yes, please.
And presumably if they are...
as a witness in court and they're going to be done in, then they can go on the witness protection program as with any other victim who is in danger.
Any other witness in danger.
Okay.
I can just also point out with regard to footnote 137, that is the return of an adult victim of trafficking. The committee suggested that this clause be moved to the chapter dealing with repatriation. This clause is now to be found at clause 34. On page 44, you will note that the information management, the whole clause has been deleted because it was inserted in clause 25 as subclause 4. That is the information that must be collected by an accredited organization. Coming to chapter 6, which deals with compensation, I see footnote 139 is on page 45, unfortunately, where the committee indicated that the clause should only be limited to subclauses 1 and 2, and that section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act should then apply. The amendment in subsection 1A is then in line with the committee's suggestion that section 300 should apply. You will see the words whereafter the provisions of section 300, 2, 3 and 4 of the Criminal Procedure Act apply. And what we have also inserted there is with the necessary changes required by the context with regard to an order made under this section. And you will see the explanation there is footnote 141, which is the NPA suggestion. Going back to footnote 140, it reads, a court may, subject to paragraph C, on its own accord or at the request of the complainant and in / victim of trafficking. The footnote there states that a decision should be taken as to which of the wording should be used, the complainant or the victim of trafficking.
Members.
In other legislation that we said it would be consistent with that. Sure there was. Was it the criminal procedure? Which clause is it again? 29 what?
29 sub 1A.
Wasn't there a reference in the Criminal Procedure Act, I think, that we said we need to be consistent with?
I don't think the Criminal Procedure Act is going to help us because 300 stays...
Injured.
They talk about an injured person. Where a person is convicted by a superior court of an offence which has caused damage to or loss of property belonging to some other person, the court may, upon the application of the injured person or the prosecutor acting on the instructions of the injured person, forthwith award. So,
Mr. Jeffrey?
I don't have the introduced bill in front of me, but I see the heading is victim of trafficking and then the word complainant is used. But now, to my mind, complainant is limiting. You may, in a trafficking case, not have a complainant. A complainant is somebody who's gone and complained that I've been trafficked, but the trafficking could have been uncovered, and all these witnesses, these trafficked women are there, some of whom are called as witnesses, but they're not really complainants, whereas the intention is that the victims of trafficking are the ones who are going to get the benefit. And so I really think it should be consistent with the heading, and that is that it's victim of trafficking, not complainant. It's victim of trafficking or the prosecutor on their behalf, or could be on their behalf.
Any differing views? No. Okay, I have Mr. Bassett.
Yeah. Thanks.
Is there not a jurisdictional issue there as well? As to the amount, we spoke about it earlier. 300 refers, has got a specific clause about compensation relating to certain amounts as set out by the minister. You might just want to check whether we need to put in a clause about jurisdiction as well.
To section 300, subsections 2, 3, and 4 apply.
301A. actually limits the jurisdiction.
Yes.
Is it foreseen that there could be larger amounts than that jurisdiction set out by the minister? Well, there's no, at the moment, as it reads here, there's no limit. There's no limit, so that's maybe better to leave it as it is. What we spoke about earlier with the penalty clause, where we would have to look at the jurisdiction of the regional court, does the regional court also has got a civil limit as far as its jurisdiction, I think, isn't it? 300,000 rand, which probably is sufficient.
I just recall now, if you have a look at clause 29, clause 29.1a says a magistrate's court may not make an order for the payment of compensation as provided for in paragraph A, which exceeds the monetary jurisdiction determined by the minister from time to time by notice in the Gazette as provided for in section 301A. So there is a limit, and as far as I can remember, the limits in terms of section 300 are pretty much the same as the criminal jurisdiction of the lower courts, which is... it differs a little bit. I think it's 100,000 rand in the case of district courts compensation orders and 300,000 rand in the case of regional courts. So our provision, our compensation provision in clause 29, if it's a lower court, cannot make a compensation order higher than 300,000.
Mine is more, the NPA, I think, wanted the amendment, and it means we don't have to cover the rest of 29 because it's the provisions of the CPA applying. My question is, why don't we just say where is the provisions of section 300, 1, 2, 3, and 4 apply? I mean, do we need 2? I mean, do we need C? You see, C was there when the rest of the provisions were not there, so that's why it had to be there. But now that we've made the specific reference to section 300 applying, if we simply put 301 in as well, then is C not necessary? So can you maybe, I don't know if they're, if you're not, Chair, if they're not 100% clear, can you maybe look at that? But it would be a proposal that we, under 29.1a, where we've got the NPA, the 141 insertion, instead of starting with 302, we start with 301. And then, because we refer to 301, we don't need to have C. And can I have a look at whether that is helpful?
Just want to understand it, what Mr. Jeffrey's saying.
If under 29.1, if section 301 of the CPA applies, where you've got suffered by the victim as a result of compensation of that offence, where after the provisions of section 301, 302, etc., apply with the necessary changes, then because you've put it in there, do you need a C? Because you're already saying 301, which is the monetary jurisdiction, applies.
See that. But where we differ, our introduced bill differs, and I think that was done very purposely, is if you have a look at clause 29.2, it says, in cases where the amount of the damage, injury, or loss suffered exceeds an order for compensation which can be made by magistrate's court, in terms of subsection 1, a civil action may be instituted by the victim for the recovery of the excess. Now, the Criminal Procedure Act section...
Fine.
It's
more that if you put 301 into A,
C should fall away. Can you see it, Mr. Bassett? So the introductory part of clause 29.1 will stay. So the court will have a wider wider power than in terms of section 300, because it's damage to loss and just physical and psychological. So, okay, I think we can do something like that. Sorry, it took me a bit long to.
Contexts. What are any necessary changes required by the context?
It's a provision that we use quite often in, when you want to piggyback on something else. An NPA, I think, I just have to confirm what they're saying, what their argument was. Matandis, yeah.
But I think, let me help. I think because you are listing under Romans 1 to 4, these other factors, then 300 doesn't, or you can't just simply
yes.
refer to 300 or just use 300.
Yeah.
So there would be a mutatis
mutandis. You've hit the nail on the head. There is a difference between 300 and our clause 29, and we must make sure that we recognise that difference.
But basically, it's just the amounts that are being used from section 300, but the grounds are wider here. Just not sure that context is.
Yes, separate issue?
On the issue of section 300 in general, there's a reference in the footnote before we delete it as to inserting something in the report. Do we still need that following Mr. J.B. Sebanyani's question to the minister last week in Parliament, where he raised the issue of section 300, and the answer was that the Law Commission is looking into that whole issue. Mm. So do we need to
put it
in at all? I don't know, before we delete that footnote. 139, there's a reference there to, the question was raised whether the minister should be requested to investigate the possibility of amending section 300, extending the scope of section 300 along the same lines. Now that would be something to come in on our report. Do we need to say that or not?
JJ.
Do we need to say that in the report?
Do we need to, yeah.
In the report.
Yeah. Yes, given that he's already answered.
We look at it for the report, but as far as the context of the bill, we keep it as is, because that wording at the bottom of 1A replaces, as far as I can see, 3, 4, 5, and 6, 3, 4, and 5 of the rest of the sections. Because 300 applies, so we don't have to repeat it. And if the minister amends 300, then it will apply to this as well. I don't have a problem with saying in the report that the minister should look at it.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you think? Just one other issue. The asset forfeiture unit.
That's coming under
47. So does the victim then still have another bite at the cherry? Not that I'm objecting to it. I'm simply saying that, well, we're setting a limit of 300,000, and the victim, I don't know.
The victim has another bite is if the amount is not enough,
right.
Under 29.2.
But that's by civil.
A civil action may be instituted by the victim.
Yeah.
So the 300,000 is the civil jurisdiction limit. The others is less than that, I'm sure. Magistrates Court's criminal jurisdiction is 60,000. I'm not sure what regional is, but I mean, the civil jurisdiction in regional is 300,000.
In terms of general jurisdiction, magistrates court, district court is 60,000 or 3 years, and the regional court is 300,000 or 15 years. Civil, I think, is 100,000 and 300. But in terms of section 300, which is all on its own, really, as far as I can recall, district court is 100,000 and a regional court is 300,000 in line with the civil.
So then effectively we're providing something that's meaningless, because they can claim up to 300,000 anywhere in the regional court and they can't claim more than that in a civil action. Yeah.
Yeah.
The law allows a claim up to these limited amounts.
Right.
What we are providing for is that you can claim for more things than you would in the Criminal Procedure Act. The issues listed in Romans 1 to 4 in 29.1a. Okay. That's why we're putting it in. Now, I agree, I think that we should, and we're then providing for, even though you can get this money through the criminal court, you can still go to the civil court if your damages are greater. And then we're saying that the minister should relook at 300 to increase the amounts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to be careful of turning a criminal court into a civil court. And so I would caution that we don't, that I think there is merit in this section, because it does increase the types of thing the victim can claim for, although the amounts and the procedure still stays the same. But I'm basically happy with the way it is as we've amended it, and would argue that we don't here try and increase the amounts. We leave that into the report to say the minister must look at 300 as a whole.
Can I just clarify? So, I mean, it's only for the easier process that we allow this, and then it says
higher than the 300, they can go to the High Court. As long as there's no possible interpretation that this is limiting that, then it's fine. So is that what 2 is now saying? They can claim whatever the balance over 300,000
in a civil suit.
So then they'll have to go to the High Court to do that?
Probably, okay, yes. Right. Because Section 300 at the moment says, and that Section 305B says that a person that accepts the damage that have been given to him or her under an order under Section 300 is precluded from taking any further action civilly if the his or her damages were more than the order that was made.
Oh. Okay.
We've got subsection 2, subclause 2 in.
Okay. But again, I raise the question of the CARA fund. The victims still have access to that, in addition to all this.
And Chair, not necessarily the victim. I think clause 29 is compensation to the victim as a person. The next clause deals with compensation to the state, and that's where CARA comes in. And CARA account is really only used for monies can be paid out of the CARA account, and we'll get to that. We've got some footnotes on that. Monies from CARA account can can only be paid to law enforcement agents and institutions that render assistance to victims of crime in general. So this is a separate thing. This is personal compensation that a court can make an order for.
All right.
And then the order for compensation to the state is to compensate the state for expenses it has had to incur.
A correction, but I remember an incident in KwaZulu-Natal where a person, there was a kidnapping incident and hostage money was paid, or there was an attachment of a monetary amount by the asset forfeiture unit that went straight to the victim. So it seems that there are some provisions that allow for compensation straight to the victim in terms of POCA or one of those asset forfeiture units, but that's purely anecdotal. I seem to remember us asking Billy Hoffman, and he gave us that example of a kidnapping situation that took place and where the money was recovered and paid straight back. But that would make sense because that money came from the victim of kidnapping.
Mr. Jeffrey?
Here's a general point I'm going to have to probably leave before the end of the meeting, but it relates to the NPA. I know Dean Debbie is very disappointed. It relates to the other amendments from the NPA, and that is that I think we need to be careful of a piecemeal change to the law. And this is where it's items for the report rather than the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So we can make some minor changes relating to, and particularly in the case of trafficking victims because we're creating the law to extend the types of things that they can claim for. I think we need to be careful to tamper too much with the existing provisions relating to to forfeiture, to claims. They need to be dealt with as a whole. So Mr. Swart's example is not a trafficking case. Okay, it seems it did work, but there may be other cases. What I'm really cautioning against is that we don't set up this, what we think is a very nice regime for trafficking victims, which then doesn't apply to other victims of crime. We need to deal with victims of crime as a whole, and that's where the issue of putting it in our report, that the amendment to Section 300 of the CPA is something that the Minister should look at. And I think the same with the forfeiture issues, particularly under 30A. I mean, my view is that it's basically, is it POCA that needs to apply? And if POCA needs to be amended, then it should be amended because it applies to everybody, not just trafficking. But it's a caution against a piecemeal approach just because we're dealing with trafficking legislation at the moment.
That's also the department's view, and you'll see the amendments that we've done to the next clause is to try and follow that approach. And I think the committee had, I recall right at the beginning of the deliberations, the committee was pretty sensitive to not or giving special treatment to victims of trafficking as against other victims of trafficking, and creating other victims of crime and creating a precedent.
Okay.
All right. Are we then saying that the department's view is not to make is purely to cross-reference to the existing legislation and then to amend the existing legislation by just inserting the offence trafficking, as, or are we repeating the sections here? Is it not easier just to keep the regime as it is at the moment of POCA and asset forfeiture unit by adding the offences to that legislation?
Talking about compensation or generally,
sorry, are we still on just to help? Are we still on? Have we finished clause 29? My understanding is we had. Okay. Oh, 38.
Okay. Yeah, I think the committee gave us a very strong sense that it can come out when we met on the 2nd of November. Yes. 30A is coming out. That was on the 2nd of November when we met.
I thought we had agreed to that.
Fit in with the consistency thing. The only aspect is whether we want to make an amendment to POCA which lists trafficking, the offence of trafficking.
Chair, we've done that.
Done that, okay.
That was an omission on our side in the introduced bill. I don't think it was in the schedule when but we've listed the offences in our bill now. In the schedule to POCA, which means that POCA is applicable to the trafficking offences, which means that forfeiture orders and all that sort of thing can apply to these offences as well.
It seems to have been there, because on your footnote 143 at the bottom, it says Schedule 1 to the bill included an amendment to Schedule 1 of POCA, inserting the offence of trafficking. And then, Chair, I just see on page 90... Of the bill before us, there is the amendment to POCA. It was actually, seems to have been in there, but it's any offence under Chapter 2 of the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons goes into Schedule 1 of POCA.
That's correct. We only had the main offence in the introduced bill, but the NPA suggested that we put the other offences in which are just as serious, and that's for the committee's consideration, but we'll highlight that when we get there.
Alright, so we've agreed 30A comes out. So we remain with 30 on page 49.
Chair, may I just sort of give an overview of what's happened here and just remind members,
yeah,
when we were last here, there was a suggestion also from the NPA that compensation orders to the state be paid into the CARA account, and we were asked to have a look at that, shouldn't we make an amendment to POCA? What we've done is, and Engela will take us through for consideration, is two alternatives. Either the money, that the court can make an order for compensation to the state, and the committee also raised a concern with what does state mean, and we've got that addressed in the footnotes. Or the other alternative is to say that when the court wants to make an order for compensation, it can order that the money be paid into CARA. Our argument or our point of view is that money, perhaps Engela can deal with that when we go through it, but there are two alternatives. Either the compensation should be made directly to the state, it goes into the National Revenue Fund, or it can be made to CARA. So that's what we've come up with. I'll ask Engela to take us through the provision.
With regard to footnote 144, I think Lawrence has just explained to you that the committee indicated that it would consider an amendment that compensation be made to CARA. We will come to that then later on. In subclause 1C, we have amended the reference there to section 9, which deals with offences by carrier, just to reflect the correct subclause there. With regard to footnote 146, we have included that part there. Maybe if I can just read the clause from the beginning. The court may, in addition to any sentence, including any sentence of imprisonment which it may impose in respect of any offence in terms of Chapter 2 of this Act, or in addition to any order for the payment of compensation to a victim in terms of Section 29, or C, in terms of Section 9.4, and D, upon application by the prosecutor, make an order for payment by the convicted person or the carrier as provided for in Section 9.4 to the state. The reason why we included the words "or the carrier as provided for in Section 9.4 is because the in terms of Section 9.4, the court may, on a balance of probabilities, find that the carrier was responsible for the committed an offence, and therefore he is liable for that. That is just to link that up. And then, as indicated by Lawrence, the option there is that the court may make an order for the payment then by the convicted person or the carrier into the criminal assets recovery account established under Section 63 of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act of 1998. With regard to then to footnote 148, we give the provisions of Section 68 there, which provide as follows. The heading is the objects of the committee. Now the committee consists of the Ministers of Justice and Constitutional Development, Police and Finance, as well as the NDPP, and if necessary, two other persons designated by the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. And the object there is then to advise Cabinet in connection with all aspects of forfeiture of property to the state, to advise Cabinet in connection with the rendering of financial assistance to law enforcement agencies in order to combat organized crime, money laundering, criminal gang activities, and so forth. And C, to advise Cabinet in connection with the rendering of financial assistance to any other institution, organization, or fund established with the object to render assistance in any manner to victims of crime. We are of the view that POCA already provides them for the rendering of financial assistance to law enforcement agencies, as well as to institutions, organizations established with the object of rendering assistance in any manner to victims of crime. The question is therefore raised whether it is advisable to single out organizations assisting victims of trafficking, possibly creating a precedent for other NGOs to request similar treatment and amendments to PORCA. And we are of the view that the monies to be paid as compensation to the state should either be paid into the state revenue fund or to CARA. And therefore we have drafted this this option that the court can order a payment into CARA.
A number of questions arise. Firstly, if we've got insertion of the offences in POCA, is it necessary to have this clause at all? And would the offence of the carrier be inserted as well under POCA? So then, are we not then just duplicating? And we need to consider, if we are duplicating, do we need to? And secondly, the issue relating to the payment into state revenue or CARA. My initial feeling is it should be limited to CARA because the minister then sits on CARA. He's the Minister of Justice, as opposed to losing in the state revenue fund where it will be very difficult to access it. In this case, he will be able to specifically say it goes to institutions that are dealing with victims of trafficking. I would agree that we don't want to limit, create the precedent as indicated, that we need to say it must be for institutions dealing with trafficking because you set a dangerous precedent. So initially I don't think it's necessary to pay into the state revenue fund. I think CARA is there set up for a specific institution, and just bearing in mind what the minister said in response to his question. He said the SA Law Commission is looking into the whole issue of Section 300, CARA, Victims Charter and everything, and is it the Law Commission? I think they're busy looking into the whole issue of victim payments, so I think it makes sense to limit it to CARA. Thank you.
Honourable members? Agreed?
Yes.
Okay, then there we have a decision, Mr. Bassett.
Sorry, just on the issue then of is it necessary to repeat the clause here if it's in CARA already, the compensation of the state, it might, and is there anything addition here, but it might be beneficial to have reference here as well. Is it, what are the implications of that?
Mr. Bassett, or anyone else?
I need to
look at it.
No, I need clarity on that.
What I'm saying is if we're referring to the offences in POCA, which refer to compensation to the state, payment into CARA, why do we need a repeat of a clause? Is this clause, compensation to the state, not already contained in the POCA provisions?
By virtue of the offences being...
offences into POCA, or does it go further here, which would then...
I think there is a difference, because here is compensation for expenses. What happens in POCA is you're going to confiscate property and you're going to get money, and all the proceeds of crime, generally, that get wrapped up in preservation orders and all those sort of things, they go into CARA. But this, I think, can be distinguished from that this is compensation for expenses that the state has had to incur for repatriating and looking after. POCA stuff is more grabbing what the perpetrator has and converting it into cash and putting it into as the proceeds of crime. So I think that's the major distinction.
Okay. Which then allows organizations and NGOs to make application to the committee. Okay. All right.
Is this a small thing? Mm-hmm. In Savoie, we use the word return, while in 31 we change it to repatriate.
Sorry, where are you now, Mr. Ambrosini?
I hope I'm at the right one.
You're on page 49.
Yeah, I'm at the beginning of page 50. It's the same. No, we second line. We use return.
Return and repatriation.
Well, but we changed return to repatriation in 31.
In 31, may not. Oh, I see.
Perhaps if I can just come in there, wherever we deal with returning victims of trafficking within the Republic, we use the word return, but when it comes to returning those victims abroad, then we use the word repatriation.
Can we not
You okay? Define what? You want to define the words return and repatriate?
When you're returning somebody from one area into another area, the concept is very, very clear, but where do you return them to? So send them back to KwaZulu-Natal, but where? It's I don't know whether we need to have some guidance. And the same thing about repatriate. Where do you repatriate to? To the country of origin? The village of origin? I mean, I know one of the problems of repatriation, and we don't care about repatriating the illegal foreigners to exactly to their point of origination, because they shouldn't be here in the first place. They're not victims. But you take them on the plane and you dump them at the airport in their country. So if they come from Nigeria, you get them to the capital, and that's where it ends. But in respect of these victims, they may be coming back from very remote areas. Where do we repatriate them to? Just to their country and drop them at the airport? Huh? Or is there any need of going one step further? I don't know, I'm just asking the question.
In terms of the bill, we do provide it, the Department of Social Development will, through International Social Services, assist in finding appropriate institutions who will assist the victim once the victim gets to that country. Obviously, you do not want to send the victim back exactly to the same circumstances that in the first place caused them to be trafficked. So we do provide, I just have to look at a specific provision, where the social development will then assist with that process in making sure that once the victim arrives in the other country, that the measures in that country will then go further and take care of that victim in terms of reintegrating the victim into society and to make sure that the victim is protected.
So they won't be dumped at the airport, at the capital? It's all set out there, Mr. Emerson. But that deals with a child and adult as well. Safety, harmed, killed, or trafficked. Inform the person in a prescribed manner of any arrangements. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, person. With regard to chapter 7, you will note the footnote there, 149, indicates this entire chapter was not discussed on 6 September and is to stand over for Department of Home Affairs discussion,
okay.
Which I suppose will take place at a later stage.
Yes. Then we move on to chapter 8. Page 55.
page 55, chapter 8, dealing with the general provisions, clause 36, dealing with the trafficking of a child by parent, guardian, or other person who has parental responsibilities and rights. You'll see in subclause 1b, footnote 168, we inserted the words in terms of section 152 of the Children's Act. We suggest this reference to bring this in line with clause 15.4c and to distinguish it from the temporary safe care for adult victims in clause 16.
Agreed, honourable members?
Agreed,
right.
In subclause 2, it reads, any action taken by a children's court in terms of subsection 1 does not exclude a person's liability for committing any offence under chapter 2 of this act, footnote 169. We suggest this amendment to ensure that all the offences in chapter 2 are covered. And that we're saying the any the offence of trafficking. It read originally the offence of trafficking in persons, but we've changed it to any offence under chapter 2.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the footnotes come out.
That's great.
Okay.
On page 56, footnote 170, dealing with national instructions and directives, this clause has been moved now to clause 44.
Fine. Footnote comes out.
On page 61, clause 38, legitimacy and validity of documents. It is also just an amendment to correct the wording there that it, the reference is to under chapter 2 and not in terms of. In other provisions, we refer to the word under.
Oh, I see. Okay, you're just making it consistent.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, honourable members. All right.
Sorry, a little silly question, stylistic. And I know that it's quite common, but would the same practice fall in legislation that one writes Director General : Home Affairs rather than the Director General of the Department of Home Affairs? I know that that's how one signs letters and how one refers to. It's common practice, but is it also legislative practice?
Thanks, Jane. It's legislative drafting practice that we do, that Director General, that we write the social development or whichever one.
Chairperson, with regard to clause 39, there are no footnotes to that clause.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's no clause relating to clause 40, dealing with the national policy framework. On page 63, footnote 172, it is just also to indicate that we've deleted this clause here, as the committee decided that it should be the responsibilities here should be carried out by the Justice Department.
Agreed, honourable members.
Mm.
Right. So the footnote comes out and that clause as well.
Yes, you will then find on page 64 the new clause, the heading coordination of responsibilities, functions and duties relating to the implementation of the Act.
Okay.
In clause 41, sub 1, It reads the Director General Justice and Constitutional Development in conjunction with, and then there was an option of the consultation with, and on the 6th of September the committee decided that they will rather go with in conjunction with. So we've deleted that option there.
So I hope that not to take back. I know what after consultation and in consultation mean. What does in conjunction with means?
I should recall the discussions, but I must confess I don't.
We don't read it and the meaning is committed or not immediately. How can we expect that people have time and everyone is consulted?
Chair, I think the normal word that's usually used is in consultation with,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps for the sake of consistency.
It can't be in consultation with, because you cannot be in consultation with three people, so it's got to be after consultation.
Why do you say that?
Because you can, in consultation means that you must do as the person you consult with tells you to.
Well, if there must be agreement. That's well, in consultation.
No, well, in consultation.
There must be agreement by all the parties mentioned there.
Otherwise, there is no action.
Yes.
So, and you're going to have a deadlock. Usually, you don't have in consultation with more than two people, with one entity, because effectively the person you consult with holds the final decision-making power. You got in consultation with the Minister of Finance. To make it clear that it is really the Minister of Finance who decides on the money.
What are we saying here, Honourable Members? The Honourable Debbie Schaefer.
We did have this discussion, and that's why we said in conjunction with, in order to avoid the issues regarding consultation in and after.
We wanted to
be responsible, but we just felt that they had to have more than just consultation, they've got to work together with, and that's why we said in conjunction with. And no, I'm not aware of any legal interpretation of in conjunction with, as there is an effect of in consultation and after consultation.
I think the question Mr. Ambrosini is raising is, in the event that all these people listed don't agree on a particular issue, then what happens?
My question is really,
or if amongst all of them there are one or two who don't agree.
Then let's put, if you want to achieve that result, we need to say after consultation, it is the department's call. My difficulty is that either I don't remember the discussion we had or I did not attend to the discussion, and I'm now faced with a text, and I ask myself, what does it mean? And so will a director general or a chief director needs to read this law.
Although this is dealing with developing a draft national policy framework and the establishment of an integrated information system. So it's not just anything and everything else.
Get guidance from the Sexual Offences Act and Child Justice Act. I can have a quick look because there's similar provisions there.
What does it say after, Steve? Can you check, please, Mr. Asset?
I don't have an objection to
offer. It's a draft national policy framework, Mr. Ambrosini, and also monitoring, integrated information system.
Now, after consultation, it would mean the Director General of Justice would need to set up the committee, invite the other people to participate, prepare a draft, circulate it around, but it is the driver.
Yes, it's quite innocuous because I see on the next page, 76 at the bottom, there was a requirement of the intersectoral committee to consult with relevant civil society organizations, and there the words are after consultation. So I think that more than adequately addresses this
after consultation. It doesn't. It's not binding. The minister doesn't have to. In consultation means he's got to get consensus buy-in from everyone.
Yeah, every single person. And bear in mind, honourable members, it deals with, as I said, drafting a draft national policy framework and an integrated information system. That's what we're asking them to do. Mrs. Williams?
Jane, I think also just taking into account, I think the concerns of this committee is also that yes, they can consult with the other stakeholders, but they can still make up their own mind after that. But I think maybe if you do something to say after consultation, but we can also have a clause which provides taking into account the views of the others. So even though they've consulted, or after having considered the views, even though there's consultation, to show that consideration was in fact given to the views of the other parties that were consulted, if they want to ensure that the views are in fact taken into account.
Is that implied? Yeah. All right. Although my understanding after consultation is that I just need to call you and tell you I'm doing this, and that's it. I've consulted with you. All right. Okay.
This Fences Act is after consultation that the minister must develop a policy framework.
All right. Now remember, honourable members, you said after consultation you didn't want to use, so you're now going back to it.
Yes.
Okay. Mm. Okay.
I think there's place for one.
Fair enough. Are we agreed?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Footnote comes out. After consultation comes back in.
Person, on page 65,
yes.
There's a footnote 174. This is just to indicate that originally we provided in clause 3 for public awareness raising programs, and that is also now part of the work of the Department of Justice. It's basically then a new paragraph D. I can maybe just also point out.
Oh, I see, right at the bottom, yeah, yes. 174, yes. Okay. All right.
Right,
well, essentially that must come out. Honourable members? Okay.
Chair, I see there's no footnote here, but along the lines that we've been discussed just now, on page 66, the new subclause 3, we also have the Director General Justice and Constitutional Development may in conjunction with the National Commissioner. The committee might wish then to reconsider that as well.
For purposes of consistency, honourable members. What are they doing here? Make recommendations to the minister with regard to the amendments of the national policy framework.
Yeah,
after good. Consultation again? Yeah. Right. You have that.
Chairperson, this clause originally did not list all the stakeholder departments that the Director General had to consult, and therefore we have then included the National Commissioner, the NDPP, and all those other role players. So you will see on page 67, footnote 175, just indicate that we have included all the role players. That will also be in line with clause 41, sub 1.
Okay. Are we happy, honourable members? Can we stop there? For today. thought we were going to go to the end of the chapter, and I kept turning and turning, and I realized we'll never get there. Mr. Bassett, Engela, Stierman, the rest of the team. Thank you. We meet again tomorrow. Punani? Yeah? Next door. At 9. And we continue with trafficking. Home affairs, Monani, we must try and get them here. But I need you to inform me if they say no, because immediately they do that, I want to speak to either the minister or the deputy minister. Okay? Please. All right, that's it. We're adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you.